Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Today's Wednesday. It's November 22, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We've got a lot of things to cover this morning. Well, start off with what's happening in the city of Yonkers. The Yonkers City Council unanimously reappoints City Clerk Vincent Spano. The Yonkers City Council voted unanimously to reappoint Vincent Spano as City Clerk for a five-year term, and every council member took the opportunity to reflect on Mr. Spano's term in office and speak to the services that his office provides, fighting modernization as well as expressing gratitude for his support to the City Council. Every member lauded City Clerk Spano on a multitude of improvements made since becoming City Clerk. Quote, he says, "I am humbled by the confidence that the Council has expressed, giving me the opportunity to serve the public for another 5 years," Ms. Spano said, and quote, "mostly, I am proud of the bipartisan recognition for all of the hard work and improvements our team has achieved." The Council spoke effusively about the modernization and improvements enacted by Mr. Spano. And during his tenure as City Clerk, Mr. Spano has added several services for the conveniences of the public. Most notably, the City Clerk added a successful passport acceptance agency that attracts individuals from both the City of Yonkers and its neighboring municipalities. And this agency has processed over 8,000 passport applications and doubled the revenue of the Office of the City Clerk. Other services added were EasyPass, extension of office hours, and online requests for vital records. Additionally, it was noted that the New York Times recognized the City Clerk and its staff for its efforts during COVID. President Lakeisha Collins Bellamy said, quote, "Mr. Spano has done an excellent job and continues to lead the way with various additions to the City Clerk's office. The creation of the Passport Acceptance Agency proved City Clerk Spano is a trailblazer, and his vision for the office continues to set us apart from other municipalities. Mr. Spano is acutely aware of the importance of every vital record, license, or permit to every person who visits the office. Quote, the public visits us for many different reasons important to them, so we always strive to provide the most professional and friendly service possible," Mr. Spano said. "I'm thankful for the work and support of my deputies and our diligent staff. I came into this job looking to make lasting improvements, and I'm committed to finding more innovative ways to benefit the people of Yonkers." Just really, he's done an exceptional job. A lot of people didn't think he'd be able to do it. I always had faith that he did, and I'm glad that I was able to perceive that in him from the very beginning. Let's look at some other things that are of importance. This is always to read. This is the work written by Brian Golden. His most recent article is, first of all his work is entitled Dare to Live Without Limits. And this particular edition is You Can't Run Away from Your Problems, again, written by Brian Golden. So no one wants problems. Escaping from problems can be much more appealing than resolving them. Running away is certainly tempting, especially when facing persistent, repetitive problems. Not only is it impossible to outrun your problems, attempting to do so exacerbates your frustration. When you try to escape, problems follow you, and this is because the problems you experience repeatedly are due to what's inside you rather than where you are. When you constantly face the same problem situations, you must look in the mirror to find the cause. And this doesn't mean all problems are necessarily your fault, but there may be some aspect of your personality causing or attracting the problems. So an effective way for resolving problems is to alter your behavior to produce better results. Jane is currently working at her fourth job in 10 years. Whenever Jane begins a new job, everything is great for the first year or so. Then things always downhill for her. Jane's coworkers start avoiding her. Her supervisor becomes more judgmental, criticizing Jane's work habits. Jane invariably changes jobs after growing dissatisfied with her work environment. She erroneously believes there is something wrong with the people she works with. In each new job, the pattern repeats itself. Needless to say, Jane is very frustrated, convinced it's next to impossible to find a decent work environment. Of course, it is possible to land in a bad job. If that's the case, changing jobs should remedy the situation. In Jane's example, the same scenario reoccurs. Perhaps Jane takes her problems with her to each new job. Jane needs to assess her interpersonal communication skills as well as her job performance before once again jumping ship. Over the last 20 years, Stephen and his family moved 5 times. Sometimes they stayed in the same area. Other times they moved to a new town estate. Wherever Stephen went, he had the same problems. The neighbors were annoying. Their house always had problems. There was too much traffic and people were rude. Was it possible for Stephen to have such bad luck? Or was there some component of Stephen's nature that always found fault with whatever situation he was in? Since Stephen has found himself in the same scenario for 2 decades, chances are he's been taking his problem with him. Unless Stephen identifies and corrects the elements of his personal responsibility for his dissatisfaction, it won't matter where or how often he moves. Ed has trouble staying in a relationship. When he meets someone new, things are great in the beginning. Then the problems develop. Ed gets impatient with his partner. He is very independent and doesn't want to adjust his lifestyle to accommodate another person. Ed has little desire to consider the needs of the person he is with. When each relationship invariably ends, Ed is relieved and starts looking for someone else with whom he will be truly compatible. The problem is, Ed's attitude is incompatible with being in a successful relationship. Ed doesn't think there's anything wrong with him. Therefore, he is destined to experience the same problems in every relationship. Should he happen to meet someone who feels the same way he does, the relationship will end even faster, since neither one of them will be willing to be considerate of the other. Don't try to outrun your problems. Objectively analyze why your problems occur. Often it can be helpful to seek input from an objective party who can give you constructive feedback. You can change your behavior and attitude to prevent the same problems from repeating themselves. This is all written by Brian Golden, and you could read his book, Dare to Live Without Limits, the book itself, and you can visit briangolden.com or your bookstore. And Brian is a management consultant, a motivational speaker, author, and adjunct professor. And you could email Brian at Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, at columnist.com. And just terrific. And I'm so honored that he permits us to reprint his comments. It's almost every week, Dare to Live Without Limits, which follows his book. And, of course, by coming onto our website, you could certainly find it online. But you could also go simply to Brian, B-R-Y-A-N-G-O-L-D-E-N, briangolden.com, and you could find his book there. You could purchase it that way. And you could have a link about where to go to get it as well on our website, but you could certainly purchase it directly through his website, which I think would be wonderful. And there's a photo of him as well and very intuitive, very sensitive man, positive ways imaginable. He really understands human behavior patterns, human nature, our failings and our faults, and at the same time, how we can climb out of our self-constructed abyss, wherever that happens to be. And there's always something that we can do to better ourselves and to better our relationships. And it's just a question of recognizing our failings as well as our successes. And not everything is negative, of course. And I think we need to celebrate who we are, including our evolution and understanding of who we are, so that we can move ahead. Because that's the whole point, isn't it? Life is a progression of time, but it's also a progression of inner development as well, and interpersonal relationships with others. And that's what it's all about. We don't live in our own bubble, or hopefully we don't. If we do, it's hopefully that we can climb out of that and interact with other people, because people are interesting. They're interested in us. But we also need to show interest in them, and that's how relationships develop. It doesn't have to be a love relationship, but certainly a relationship of mutual understanding and camaraderie, friendships, and so on and so forth. If it develops to something else, well, that's fine as well, too. So there are so many levels of relationships, and the beauty is you have the capacity to explore them, and why not? So I think that's really, really important stuff. Okay, let's look at some other stuff that hopefully you'll find of interest. Bear with me a moment. Yes, I wanted to tell you about this. This is a column from Bronxville Mayor Mary Marvin Esquire. So she writes, "This coming Friday marks the official start of the holiday shopping season, kicking off with a shop local campaign countrywide. In the village," meaning the village of Bronxville, "to encourage your participation, John Gordon of Admiral Realty has bought out all the meters on Saturday, November 25th, on Pondfield Road, Craft Avenue, Park Place, and Cedar Street. There will be free parking afternoon, at noontime in the Craft Avenue lot, Kensington Road garage, and the Garden Avenue lot, complements of the village. The next month of shopping is honestly a make or break for some of our merchants, as they count on this period to balance out the quiet of July and August. Bronxville is so fortunate to have one of the highest concentrations per square foot of locally owned independent businesses in the county, many of our businesses having been with us 20 plus years, and one even 60 plus years, creating a stabilizing force in our village. Our downtown and its robust storefronts and retail occupancy is the envy of my mayoral colleagues. We are truly home to a gem of a downtown. Our merchants also do so much more than offer you well-curated, beautifully wrapped, and easy-to-exchange items, as they live in a relationship-based economy and further help the village by buying parking permits, goods, and foods from their fellow merchants, and use the services of our local professionals, including lawyers, accountants, computer consultants, and graphic designers. They also pay a great deal of taxes that go directly to support village government and our school. The money reinvested in the community is real. Of $100 spent locally, 68% or more than twice that of a big box store purchase stays in the community. In addition, the sales tax revenue that is generated for the village's budget is critical to our bottom line, translating to over $1.7 million or 25% of our non-property tax revenues. If we all decided to go the mail order route, the loss of this tax revenue would translate into either a whopping 15% increase in the village side of your taxes or a drastic decrease in municipal services. Shopping Local also sends a message to our most charitable merchants that their presence in the village is valued and appreciated, as small businesses donate more than twice as much per sales dollars to local nonprofit events and teams compared to big companies. An unbelievable 91% of our local businesses contribute to local charities and institutions, a staggering 200% more than chain stores or mail order operations. One only has to look at the raffle prizes or auction catalogs of our local charitable organizations or school fundraisers to see that the names that appear as donors include businesses such as Underhill's Crossing, Silk Road, and Silver Spoon, not Amazon, Costco, or Zappos. In the end, we must support our supporters. In addition, it's been conclusively proven that home values are directly related to the condition and vitality of one's local business community. The nexus between often one's greatest personal assets and local commerce is indisputable. A downtown filled with empty stores severely affects the sale value of nearby homes. It is just a fact. In addition to the extremely important financial benefits, the environment is positively affected as people walk more when shopping locally. Less gas is consumed, air quality is better versus traveling to a mall or a big box store or buying items on the internet where the shipping methods adds 1 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide per year to the environment and further compounded on the cost of those Amazon boxes, which are so wasteful to the environment. As an added benefit, a walkable downtown allows our younger residents to receive an appropriate degree of independence when allowed to walk to town for school supplies or an after-school treat. Bronxville also has the potential to be a blue zone, an area in the world where people live much longer than their neighboring countrymen, with the key factor being personal human interaction. And those who live in blue zones make purchases in person by walking to their nearby businesses, grocery stores, or visiting doctors and other professionals, thus sustaining local interpersonal ties not only with store staff, but those waiting in line to be at the post office, waiting room, or bagel store. The endorphins released, all scientifically proven, genuinely contribute to happiness and thus longevity. So if you want to live a long life, shop on Podfield Road. The trustees and I, as champions of shop local, quote unquote, also realize it is not possible to purchase everything you need locally. We just ask that you think local first, as it ends up being your best choice. You will not only be getting a beautifully curated gift or a delicious meal, perhaps helping your neighbor keep a job, supporting our nonprofits, or making someone else's day simply by smiling with a purchase. Bottom line, shopping in the village is your biggest bargain. That is such a compelling article, of course, written by Mayor Mary Marvin. Always a thrill reading her work. Let me just quickly look. Did I do this? Yes, I did. Bear with me a moment here. One second. All right, bear with me a moment. I lost my way somehow. Okay, let me see if I can get here. All right, one second here. One moment, where is it? Okay, hopefully I can get to the right place now and catch up with you on some other issues. Yes, this is really very important. I wanted to read this to you. This is article is entitled "Which Medicare Option is Really Advantageous?" It's written by Larry M. Elkin, CPA and CFP of Palisades Hudson Financial Group. So he says, "I know a lot of bright, well-read, capable people by the Medicare initial sign-up process and who find the annual open enrollment period not much easier to navigate. Some of them I found when I went through the process myself was by design and not necessarily the government's design. So you got quite a few issues. There's Medicare Part A, which provides coverage for inpatient care at hospitals, as well as in certain other facilities such as skilled nursing facilities and hospice care providers. Then there's Medicare Part B, which covers healthcare expenses outside hospitals, including doctor visits, outpatient care, and preventative care like vaccines. It can also cover durable medical equipment, including wheelchairs and walkers. Medicare Part C is a Medicare-approved plan offered by a private company. It serves in place of Parts A and B, sometimes Part D as well. And Part D helps to cover the cost of prescription medications. So they discuss the basics of these four options more thoroughly in their book, Looking Ahead, Life, Family, Wealth, and Business After 55. So some of the confusion about Medicare centers on when to sign up and on the financial penalties for not signing up when you first become eligible. And this eligibility is still age 65 in the vast majority of cases, even though the normal retirement age for Social Security benefits is gradually rising to 67 for people born in 1960 or later. More specifically, the window for Medicare enrollment is usually 3 months before your 65th birthday to 3 months after, yielding a seven-month window. And millions of people become eligible for Medicare years before they actually retire. Others retire on Social Security at reduced benefits as early as age 62, but must wait until age 65 to get health insurance coverage under Medicare. Starting later than age 65 can carry consequences, and these vary by which part you delay. If you sign up for Part A later than you could have, your premium will rise by 10% as long as you are not eligible for zero premium Part A coverage, as I will discuss later in this article. You will pay this higher premium amount each month for twice the number of years you could have signed up but didn't. For Part B, the penalty is 10% for every year you could have signed up but did not. You pay these higher rates indefinitely. And for Part D, the penalty is 1% for each month you could have signed up and didn't. So 12% per year. And like Part B, these higher rates persist as long as you participate. Note that there are some exceptions, such as qualifying for a special enrollment period for Part B. But be cautious all the same. Note that if you are already receiving Social Security benefits at age 65, you may be automatically enrolled in Medicare Parts A and B. For the large majority of people, although not for everyone, the best time to sign up for Medicare is in the window that begins 3 months before turning age 65. This lets Medicare take effect as of the first day of the month in which the applicant's 65th birthday occurs. But what Medicare plan do you sign up for? And thanks to the ubiquity of modern databases and the marketing efficiency of health insurers, beneficiaries and beneficiaries to be is themselves inundated with advertisement for all-inclusive health plans that are pitched as better than Medicare. And many offer zero premiums, zero deductible, zero copay, better than Medicare benefits such as dental coverage and even non-medical perks such as health club members. It sounds so good that there has to be a catch, right? And the answer is right. The major catch is that these plans each have their own network of doctors, hospitals, pharmacies, and other service providers. And those networks are typically limited in geographic care facilities, even within their home territory. This makes little difference for a healthy young retiree whose needs involve little more than an annual checkup and maybe a cholesterol-lowering daily statin pill. But some more elaborate forms of care may only be available in a limited number of places and after enduring a waiting list if they are available at all. Medicare Advantage plans also often require prior authorization for many procedures and medications. And when retirees are on the road, these plans may only cover a limited amount of emergency care. The opportunity to change plans back to, quote, traditional and, quote, Medicare generally comes along only once per year. In the annual enrollment period, unless you move out of your Medicare Advantage plan service area or qualify for a special enrollment period under some other limited exception. Now, millions of people are happy to make these sacrifices in favor of the cost savings and expanded benefits that a Medicare Advantage plan offers. According to KFF, formerly the Kaiser Family Foundation, slightly more than half of Americans eligible for Medicare enrolled in such plans in 2023. I have no quarrels with their choice. That said, if you are a snowbird or otherwise split your time between disparate parts of the country, if you travel extensively, or if you prize the ability to choose from the widest set of providers without worrying about whether you are in network, you probably won't be among these satisfied customers. You'll likely be much happier with some combination of Medicare Parts A, B, and D, along with a Medigap plan. It is important to understand the difference between Medicare Advantage plans and Medigap plans. Medigap coverage is not a substitute for Medicare Parts A, B, and D, but rather a supplement to them, at least to the first two. Medigap policies do not cover prescription drugs. Participants buy Medigap coverage from a private insurer and use this coverage to help pay the patient's share of costs in original Medicare. In most cases, you have 6 months to enroll in a Medigap plan, beginning in the first month where you both have Medicare Parts B and are 65 or older. While it is possible to enroll in a Medigap plan after this window, you may have fewer options and they are likely to be more expensive. You cannot purchase a Medigap plan if you participate in a Medicare Advantage plan. Medigap policies receive letter classifications such as Plan G or Plan K, with benefits and limitations standardized between companies. The only difference among plans of a given letter grade is the premium cost, which can vary widely, and whether a particular insurer offers that plan in your zip code. A good place to start is with the AARP Medicare Supplement Plan, which is underwritten by United Healthcare. It requires AARP membership, $16 per year or less. The nature of Medigap means that individuals can face a dilemma if they start on a Medicare Advantage plan and later plan or want to switch to traditional Medicare. While this is possible, it usually means the beneficiary has missed the window in which pre-existing conditions or risk factors. While there are some other situations that it can obligate insurers to cover coverage, to offer coverage, and a few states require insurers to offer coverage at all times, many Medicare Advantage plans participants run the risk of being unable to secure supplemental coverage that is affordable or being unable to secure such coverage at all. For Medicare drug benefits, other than drugs administered during a hospital stay or certain outpatient procedures, you will need to sign up for Medicare Part D. KFF found that in 2023, beneficiaries could choose between an average of 24 Part D plans, with premiums ranging from $6 per month to $111 per month. Medicare.gov has a convenient and effective tool in which you can enter your current prescriptions and your zip code, and it will provide an estimate of your annual drug costs and premium payments for plans offered in your area. Of course, you won't know during your initial enrollment period or the annual open enrollment periods that follow whether your Part D plan is going to be the cheapest option if you get an expensive new prescription during the upcoming year, or whether it will stay the cheapest option in the following year, even if your medications don't change. Prescription drug plans, Part D plans, include a formulary that divides medications into tiers, and those formularies differ between insurers. Adding complications, some plans designate certain pharmacies as preferred, so you could pay more at CVS than Walgreens, or vice versa. It's worthwhile to check your situation each year during the annual enrollment period so you can change plans on January 1, if doing so is to your advantage. Otherwise, you'll be re-enrolled in your current plan by default. If you want to take advantage, you want to make changes in your Medicare selection after the initial sign-up, you only have limited time windows in most cases to do it. The widest window is the annual Medicare open enrollment period, which runs from October 15th to December 7th, to take effect the following calendar year. And during this window, you can freely change from traditional Medicare to Medicare Advantage plans or vice versa, and drop or change a Part D prescription drug plan, or change from one Medicare Advantage plan to another. And once this window closes, you are locked into these decisions for most of the upcoming calendar year, unless another exception applies. The biggest exception is a Medicare Advantage open enrollment period that runs from January 1 to March 31. In this period, you can switch from Medicare Advantage plan, from one Medicare Advantage plan to another, or drop your Medicare Advantage plan and return to the traditional Medicare Part A, Part B, and if drug coverage is desired, Part D programs. But you can't switch in the other direction from traditional Medicare plans to Medicare Advantage until the next autumn open enrollment period. So Medicare is essentially the biggest nationwide network of health providers on the market. If a provider accepts any insurance at all, traditional Medicare likely first on the list, and it is often the least expensive option for its participants. A traditional Medicare plan coupled with a Plan G supplement, the broadest coverage still sold in the Medigap market, and a Part D plan is the most comprehensive coverage available to most of the general retiree market. Only some Cadillac, quote-unquote, government union and corporate executive plans without restricted provider networks compare. Finally, how much does all this cost? As I've mentioned, some of it depends on which approach you take, as well as your location. But your income may also affect the answer. For most people, Part A premiums are based solely on how long the individual or their spouse worked. If you or your spouse worked for 40 calendar quarters, 10 years, or more in the U.S., you can expect no monthly premium. Part B, however, charges a monthly premium based on income. At this writing, individuals who earn $97,000 or less annually pay $164.90 per month for Part B. This also applies to married couples. $194,000 or less above that threshold, premiums rise with incomes up to $500,000 for individuals or $750,000 for couples. At or above that amount, monthly premiums are $560.50 in 2023. Part D premiums can also rise for higher income beneficiaries. Even with the maximum income-based surcharges, you'll probably find that Medicare is a health insurance bargain compared to the premiums you or your employer would have paid in the private insurance market immediately before you signed up. Medicare is the country's biggest single health care buyer, and it has the muscle to largely set its own pricing. Plus, it benefits from a dedicated revenue stream in the form of payroll taxes, in addition to the premiums it charges. Yes, the Medicare program is built on financially shaky ground, but that's a topic for another day. When you start enjoying all these Medicare benefits, members to thank your working age kids. They are doing a lot to help pay for it. Just so you know, Palisades Hudson Financial Group, Larry M. Elkin is the founder and president of Palisades Hudson and is based out of Palisades Hudson's Fort Lauderdale, Florida headquarters. He wrote several of the chapters in the firm's recent updated book, Looking Ahead, Life, Family, Wealth, and Business After 55. His contributions include Chapter 1, Looking Ahead When Youth Is Behind Us, and Chapter 4, The Family Business. Larry was also among the authors of the firm's book, The High Achiever's Guide to Wealth. You could read the article online, as well as other articles that are featured by Palisades Hudson, and they're all linked on the website. So hopefully you'll find them of pertinence to you. And I can't imagine why they wouldn't. They are definitely of interest to you yourself or to others that you may know. Now, let me just quickly look at some other things I want you to check. Bear with me a moment. Okay. Bear with me a moment here. Well, the first hostages to be freed under a deal with Hamas is going to take place tomorrow, the Israeli foreign minister said. Israel expects to recover on Thursday the first hostages being freed from the Gaza Strip by Hamas under a foreign-mediated deal, Israeli Foreign Minister Eli Cohen told Army Radio on Wednesday. The agreement marks the first major diplomatic breakthrough in the conflict and allows at least 50 hostages and scores of Palestinian prisoners to be freed, while offering besieged Gaza residents a four-day truce and humanitarian aid after weeks of all-out war. And bear with me a second. Now, Israel's cabinet approved a ceasefire with Hamas that includes the release of 50 hostages in exchange for 150 Palestinian prisoners. The deal will allow hundreds of humanitarian, medical, and fuel aid trucks to enter all parts of the Gaza Strip. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said before the cabinet voted early on Wednesday that the war would continue even if a deal was reached. The Hamas-run health ministry said an Israeli airstrike on Monday on the Indonesian hospital killed at least 12 people. The World Health Organization has warned that medical services in Gaza have suffered catastrophic damage. And Israel launched attacks on Gaza after Hamas militants crossed the border on October 7th and killed 1,200 Israelis. More than 240 others were taken hostage. 1,300 people, mostly civilians, have been killed in Gaza since Israel started its military operation, according to health authorities in the Hamas-run Palestinian enclave. Well, the U.S. opposes displacement of Gazans to another country, says the U.S. Special Envoy. The U.S. is against the displacement of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to another country, U.S. Special Envoy for Humanitarian Affairs in the Middle East, David Satterfield, has told Lebanese broadcaster Al-Jadid. Satterfield said that Palestinians displaced from northern Gaza to the southern districts due to Israel's military operation, quote, must be allowed to return to homes in the north as soon as possible, end quote. He said the U.S., quote, wants to see Israel succeed in its campaign, end quote, and warned Hezbollah to hold missile fire on Israel if it wanted to avoid an escalation. So from grandfather to grandchildren, more than 50 from the same family were killed in Gaza. With hours to go before the truce deal begins, Israeli military operations in the Gaza Strip have continued to date. More than 50 members of the same family have been killed in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, according to the Palestinian foreign minister. Only this morning from the Fadura family in Jabalia, 52 people have been wiped out, completely killed. Palestinian foreign minister Riyad al-Maliki said on the sidelines of a briefing by Arab and Muslim foreign ministers in London, quote, I have the list of the names, 52 of them. They were wiped out completely from grandfather to grandchildren. Pope Francis meets relatives of Israeli hostages and Palestinians living in Gaza. Pope Francis met separately today with relatives of Israeli hostages in Gaza, with Palestinians living through the war in Gaza. The meetings in the Vatican were arranged before the latest Israeli-Hamas hostage deal was announced. After the two meetings, the Pope spoke about the suffering of both Israelis and Palestinians and begged for an end to what he called terrorism and the, quote, passions that are killing everyone. In the VIP seats of St. Peter's Square, people were holding Palestinian flags and scarves, as well as small posters showing apparent bodies in a ditch with the word genocide written underneath. Here we've gone beyond war. This isn't war anymore. This is terrorism, Francis said. Please let us go ahead. He also has God to help both Israelis and Palestinians, quote, resolve problems and not go ahead with passions that are killing everyone in the end, end quote. Gilad Shalit has been released for lessons from the last prisoner swap. Here's a look at the last Israel-Palestinian prisoner swap before the latest Qatari negotiated hostage release deal between Israel and Hamas. On October 18 of 2011, Franco-Israeli national and IDF soldier Gilad Shalit was released after more than 5 years of Hamas captivity in Gaza. The image of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu welcoming Shalit at the Tel Hof Air Base is considered a symbol of Israel's hostage policy. But Shalit's release came at a high price for Israel. The swap involved the release of 1,027 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails, including Hamas's chief in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar. Then Israel's Syria's two main airports are still shut month after Israeli strikes, says a monitor. Syria's two main airports are still shut a month after a simultaneous Israeli strikes put them out of service, the longest such closure since the Syrian conflict began, a war monitor said on Wednesday. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights also reported two Israeli strikes near the capital of Damascus on Wednesday, targeting Lebanon's Hezbollah group, a Damascus ally. Flights to and from Damascus and Aleppo Airport have been suspended since the October 22 strike damaged the runways. Rami Abdel Rahman, head of the Britain-based observatory, said both airports are closed despite the completion of repairs. Then we hear that another Israeli-Hamas prisoner swap will take place this month, says the Palestinian official. The Israel-Hamas deal agreed upon Wednesday for the freeing of 50 hostages held in Gaza in exchange for the release of 150 Palestinian prisoners will be repeated later this month, a Palestinian official told Reuters. The official who spoke on condition of anonymity said that would mean a total release of 100 of the around 240 people Hamas seized during its October 7 killing spree in southern Israel. Then we hear that the Indian Prime Minister Modi says that the Israel-Hamas conflict shouldn't become regional. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said on Wednesday it is necessary to ensure that the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza does not expand into a regional conflict. Modi was speaking at the opening of a virtual summit of G20 nations, of which India holds the presidency. Gaza hostages include babies, elderly, and entire families. Following the announcement that Gaza militant group Hamas will release at least 50 hostages as part of a deal with Israel, here's what we know about the captives. Based on interviews with relatives and Israeli media reports, Agence France-Presse has confirmed the identities of 210 of the around 240 people abducted on October 7 during Hamas's attack on military outposts, communities, and a desert music festival. The hostages, who are set for staggered release in return for a four-day truce and the release of Palestinian prisoners, are women and children, and included both Israelis and foreigners. The U.S. has said that three Americans, including three-year-old Abigail Moore Idan, will be among the first captives to be released starting on Thursday. One or two French hostages are also due to be released. French lawmaker Meir Habib told a French Jewish radio station. Four female hostages have already been released by Hamas, and one female soldier was rescued by Israeli forces. Qatar burnishes his role as essential, quote-unquote, hostage negotiator with the Israel-Hamas deal. The Emirate of Qatar has further boosted its status as a specialist power in resolving delicate hostage situations by using its influence to help secure the release of hostages by Palestinian militant group Hamas. Analysts say that Qatar has honed a careful balancing act, allowing it to marry warm relations with Western powers while maintaining ties with radical groups and states regarded as pariahs even by close allies. Qatar's foreign ministry spokesman Majed Al-Ansari told Agence France-Presse the breakthrough ceasefire deal on Wednesday morning had underlined the country's singular diplomatic position. Quote, this is what we can do that nobody else can do, and this is us using all of our abilities, he said. We've geared the whole country towards this. If it doesn't work, all hell will break loose. Well, Francis Macron is going to discuss the Middle East situation with Arab foreign ministers. French President Emmanuel Macron will today discuss the situation in the Middle East with foreign ministers from major Arab and majority Muslim countries, his office said. Joining the talks at the Elysee Palace in Paris will be the top diplomats from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, the Palestinian territories, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Turkey, the presidency added, as well as Arab League boss Ahmed Abu Khit. Jordan's King Abdullah is heading to Cairo in stepped-up efforts to end the Gaza war. Jordan's King Abdullah headed on Wednesday to Cairo for talks with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi on how to end, quote, Israel's aggression against the Palestinians, end quote, a palace statement said. The talks will focus on how to turn a four-day truce agreed between Israel and Hamas into a permanent ceasefire that brings an end to the Israeli bombardment of Gaza and averts a humanitarian catastrophe, an official told Reuters. Well, the United Nations welcomes the Israel-Hamas deal as an important step. The United Nations on Wednesday welcomed the deal between Israel and Hamas to free hostages and pause the fighting and bombardment in Gaza, but said much more needed to be done. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, quote, welcomes the agreement reached by Israel and Hamas with the mediation of Qatar, supported by Egypt and the United States. And this is an important step in the right direction, but much more needs to be done, a spokesman for Guterres said in a statement. Turkey hopes that the Hamas-Israel deal will help completely end the conflict. Turkey on Monday said it hoped a deal between Israel and Hamas to free hostages and pause the fighting and bombardment in Gaza could help bring a full end to the war. Quote, we hope that the humanitarian pause will help to completely end the conflict as soon as possible and initiate a process towards a just and lasting peace on the basis of a two-state solution, the Turkish Foreign Ministry said in a statement. At least 191 people sheltering in UNRWA schools have been killed since the start of the war. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, UNRWA, said on X that at least 191 people sheltering at UNRWA schools have been killed and 798 have been reported injured in Gaza since the start of the war. Arab ministers welcome Israel, Hamas truce, but call for extended cessation of hostilities. Arab foreign ministers welcomed an agreement for a temporary truce between Israel and Gaza militant group Hamas on Wednesday. It said it should be extended and become a first step towards a full cessation of hostilities. Foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan said at a roundtable discussion with journalists in London that the agreement, which includes hostage releases and stepped up aid into the devastated Gaza Strip, should also ultimately lead to a resumption of talks for a two-state solution. The Arab foreign ministers are leading a so-called contact group of mostly Muslim countries which are lobbying Israel's major allies to bring about an end to the Gaza war. Israel expects the first Gaza hostages to be released on Thursday. Israel expects to recover on Thursday the first hostages being freed from the Gaza Strip by Hamas under a foreign-mediated deal, Israeli Foreign Minister Eli Cohen told Army Radio. Interviewed on Wednesday, he declined to confirm a report that the process would begin at 5 a.m. That's 3 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time. Macron hails the Hamas-Israel deal, says he's working to free all hostages. President Emmanuel Macron on Wednesday hailed the truce deal between Israel and Hamas in a post on social media platform X. Quote, we are working tirelessly to release all hostages. The humanitarian truce announced should allow to introduce aid and rescue the civilians in Gaza, Macron said. I welcome the announcement of an agreement for the release of hostages and the humanitarian truce. We are working tirelessly to release all hostages. Humanitarian truce announced should allow to introduce aid and rescue the civilians in Gaza. So wrote Emmanuel Macron. That's dated today. The Kremlin also welcomed the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. The Kremlin on Wednesday hailed the ceasefire agreement in Gaza as the, quote, first step. First good news for a long time, end quote, in the Israel-Palestinian conflict and said humanitarian pauses were the only way to build efforts for a sustainable settlement. Egypt Sisi hails the Gaza truce it mediated with Qatar and the United States. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi hailed the success Wednesday of the mediation it conducted alongside Qatar and the United States in brokering a, quote, humanitarian truce, end quote, in the Gaza Strip. Sisi also welcomed the planned exchange of hostages for prisoners held in Israeli jails, his office had said. About the casualty figures from Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry. Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, the largest in the enclave, receives data from every hospital in the Strip. Hospital administrators say they keep records of every wounded person occupying a bed and everybody arriving at a morgue. The ministry also collects from other sources, including the Palestinian Red Crescent. The health ministry does not report how Palestinians were killed, whether from Israeli air strikes and artillery barrages or errant Palestinian rocket fire. It describes all casualties as victims of Israeli aggression, quote unquote, and the ministry also does not distinguish between civilians and combatants. Throughout the four wars and numerous skirmishes between Israel and Hamas, United Nations agencies have cited the Hamas-run health ministry's death tolls in regular reports. The International Committee of the Red Cross and Palestinian Red Crescent also used the numbers. In the aftermath of war, the United Nations Humanitarian Office has published final death tolls based on its own research into medical records. The United Nations counts have largely been consistent with the Gaza health ministries with small discrepancies. And some key developments since November 21. At least 13,000 Palestinians, including at least 5,500 children, have been killed in Israeli strikes on Gaza since October 7th, the government media office in the Hamas-controlled enclave said on Saturday. Now, some 1,200 people have been killed in Israel, mostly during the initial attack by Hamas, and around 240 were taken captive by militants. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told his cabinet on Tuesday night that a hostage deal is in the right decision, quote unquote. U.S. President Joe Biden said that a deal to free some of the more than 200 hostages being held by Hamas in Gaza was, quote, very close, end quote. Israel, the U.S., and Qatar, which mediates with Hamas, had been negotiating for weeks to secure hostage release deal that would be paired with a temporary ceasefire and the entry of more humanitarian aid into Gaza. It seems that the hostage deal is the right decision, that Netanyahu tells the cabinet yesterday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the cabinet on Tuesday night that a hostage deal is the right decision, end quote. U.S. President Joe Biden said earlier on Tuesday that a deal to free some of the more than 200 hostages being held by Hamas in Gaza was very close, end quote, quote unquote. And Israel, the U.S., and Qatar, which mediates with Hamas, have been negotiating for weeks to secure a hostage release deal that would be paired with a temporary ceasefire and the entry of more humanitarian aid into Gaza. And so that was the case. One second. One moment here. Okay, one moment. All right. The question is a truce and a hostage deal a possible prelude to a political exit to the Israel-Hamas war? A temporary ceasefire agreement to facilitate the release of dozens of people taken hostage during Hamas's raid on Israel is expected to bring the first respite to war-weary Palestinians in Gaza and a glimmer of hope to the families of the captives. Israel and Hamas agreed to the four-day halt, which was announced on Wednesday, and will also see the release of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. The deal brokered by Qatar, the U.S., and Egypt was made public as fighting intensified in central neighborhoods of Gaza City. Egypt's state-run Kahia TV channel said the truce would take effect on Thursday morning, local time. It caps weeks of fitful indirect negotiations and sets the stage for a tense period that could determine the course of the war, which was set off by Hamas on October 7th, Hamas's October 7 raid, and that killed has killed more than 11,000 Palestinians, according to health authorities. Hamas and other militant groups abducted some 240 people and killed at least 1,200 people. Israel and Hamas and Qatar have released details, different details of the agreement, but those details do not appear to contradict each other. And Qatar announced on Wednesday that Hamas will release 50 hostages in exchange for what Hamas said would be 150 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. And those released by both sides will be women and minors. The hostages would be released in bursts throughout the ceasefire. And once the first batch is released, Israel is expected to free the first group of Palestinian prisoners. Israel said that the truce would be extended by a day for every 10 additional hostages released. Qatar said that Israel would also allow more fuel and humanitarian aid into Gaza, but did not provide details. Now that Israel and Hamas have reached a deal on a ceasefire and hostages, Franz Van Katz, Nadia Massi, is joined by Dr. Joseph Bahut, professor and director of Islam Affairs Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at American University of Beirut, and she wrote this article. Bear with me a moment here. Okay. Some latest update, it's only about an hour ago. This is about 11 hours ago. The Israel-Hamas war, evidently there's a break in fighting, which is expected on Thursday. A pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas militants is expected to begin Thursday morning. At least 50 hostages will be released by Hamas amid a four-day pause in fighting with Israel. Bear with me a moment here. The Swiss government announced that it will introduce a draft legislation by the end of February to ban any activities linked to Hamas in the country. The act will provide the federal authorities with the necessary tools to counter any Hamas activities or support for the organization in Switzerland, the government said in a statement. It also called for respect for international humanitarian law, particularly the protection of civilians during the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Quote, in view of the dramatic humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, the Federal Council stresses the need to ensure unimpeded humanitarian access. Humanitarian pauses are necessary for this purpose. Israel, the United States, Germany, and several other nations designated Hamas as a terror organization. 3 hours ago, we hear that the United Nations welcomed the Israel-Hamas deal as an important step. The United Nations has welcomed the Israel-Hamas hostage deal in Gaza, will see a pause in fighting for 4 days. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres welcomes the agreement reached by Israel and Hamas with the mediation of Qatar, supported by Egypt and the United States, the spokesperson said in a statement. Quote, this is an important step in the right direction, but much more needs to be done, the spokesperson added. Guterres said that the United Nations would provide support for the implementation of the deal. The World Health Organization, WHO, has also welcomed the agreement while adding that it would not be enough to end human suffering. Quote, we welcome the announcement of the Israel-Hamas agreement for 50 Israeli hostages to be released, World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on social media. He too welcomed the four-day pause in fighting. However, he went on to say that the deal is, quote, not enough to end the suffering of civilians, and quote, that those still in captivity must receive any needed medical care. Continuing, he said, we continue to call for all hostages to be released, Tedros said. We also continue to call for a ceasefire so that civilians in Gaza can receive sustained, safe, and scaled-up support for recovery. The U.S., European Union, Germany, and other governments consider Hamas to be a terrorist group. The brother of hostages hopes the truce will lead to more releases. A brother of one of the hostages held by Hamas militants in Gaza welcomed the deal between Israel and Hamas to secure the release of some hostages. Quote, we are feeling thrilled and we are waiting for this deal. We are very firm that we support this deal for the last few weeks since it came into critical stages before approval, Gili Roman told Deutsche Welle. His sister, Yalden Roman, is one of about 240 people taken hostage by Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups during their terror attacks on southern Israel on October 7. Roman said he does not know if his sister will be among the 50 hostages that Hamas agreed to release in exchange for a four-day pause in fighting in Gaza and the release of 150 Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. I'm excited. I want to see them back already, he said. Whatever happens, he hoped the Red Cross would be given access to the remaining hostages in Gaza. Quote, I believe that is a step forward, end quote. Roman also said that the Israeli government should continue to push for the release of more hostages. Quote, I hope much more people are alive and can be released, and that might take a while longer. But it doesn't mean that after this deal, this is the end of the civilians and soldiers that can be saved, Roman said. We want to see all the hostages back. We understand that it might come with difficulty to the military, but we also want to see a safe and secure Israel for all citizens, he added. This is about 4 hours ago, the hostage deal. There's a pause in fighting expected to start on Thursday. The first group of Israeli hostages in Gaza is expected to be released on Thursday, Israeli Foreign Minister Eli Cohen told the military-operated Army radio. He declined to confirm reports about a specific time. Egypt's state-run Kahela television channel reported that the pause in fighting was expected to commence at 10 o'clock. A local time, which is 8 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time. Musa Abu Malzouk, a member of the Hamas Political Bureau, told Qatari news broadcaster Al Jazeera he also expected the pause in fighting to begin on Thursday morning. One second. Israel's Ben Gavir slams the hostage deal. Israeli Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has slammed the hostage deal between Israel and Hamas. In a lengthy post on social media on Wednesday, the far-right politician called the deal, quote, immoral, illogical, and very far from enough, end quote. According to the Times of Israel, Ben-Gvir welcomed the return of 50 hostages from Gaza, but said, quote, we have no right or permission to agree to the idea of separating them and only bringing some back. He also said that the pause in fighting would militarily benefit Hamas, which is listed as a terrorist group by the United States, European Union, Germany, and others. Ben-Gvir was among the Israeli ministers who voted against the deal on Tuesday night. Many Israeli and world leaders have welcomed the deal, as have families of the many of the hostages taken by Hamas in the October 7 attacks in southern Israel. Well, the IDF says that it struck Hamas targets ahead of the expected pause in fighting. Israel's military struck Hamas targets in the Gaza Strip on Wednesday morning before an expected mutually agreed pause in fighting officially goes into effect. Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, said in a post on Telegram that its troops destroyed a tunnel from which a Hamas fighter exited. Hamas is classified as a terrorist group by the U.S., the European Union, Germany, and other governments. Moreover, IDF troops identified terrorists and located weapons in a structure used by the Hamas terrorist organization, the army said. Quote, the troops killed the terrorists and destroyed the structure, end quote. IDF spokesperson Peter Lerner said that military activities will be paused in accordance with government directives. Quote, the operations are ongoing, he told Deutsche Welle on Wednesday morning. The reality on the ground is that Hamas are still engaging our forces, but we are seeking them out and pursuing them wherever they are. 1 second. Germany's Annalena Baerbock, the German foreign minister, joined world leaders in welcoming the agreement between Israel and Hamas militants. She says, quote, "The announced release of a first major group of hostages is a breakthrough, even if nothing in the world can undo their suffering," end quote. Baerbock wrote on social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter. This is what she wrote in Außenministerium Annalena Baerbock, "Die angekündigte Freilassung einer ersten größeren Gruppe von Geiseln ist ein Durchbruch, auch wenn nichts auf der Welt ihr Leid ungeschehen machen kann. Die humanitäre Pause muss genutzt werden, um lebensnotwendige Hilfe zu den Menschen in Gaza zu bringen." So, that's the translation from the German that I read to you initially. A European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen wholeheartedly, quote-unquote, welcomed the agreement between Israel and the militant group Hamas on Wednesday. She says, "I share the joy of the families that can soon embrace their loved ones once again," she said, "and I am so grateful to all those who have worked tirelessly through diplomatic channels in recent weeks to broker this agreement." Von der Leyen added, "I call on the terrorist Hamas to immediately release all hostages and allow them to return home safely," she said. President Joe Biden said he welcomed a deal that will secure the release of hostages taken by Hamas during the October 7 terror attacks on Israel, adding that U.S. hostages would be among those released. Biden said he is extraordinarily gratified, quote unquote, that some of the hostages, quote, will be reunited with their families once this deal is fully implemented, end quote. He added that the deal should, quote, bring home more American hostages, end quote. A senior U.S. official said that three Americans are expected to be among the 50 released hostages. Quote, "As president, I have no higher priority than ensuring the safety of Americans held hostage around the world, and I will not stop until they are all released," he said in a statement on social media. Biden also thanked Qatar and Egypt's leaders for their, quote, "critical partnership," end quote, in reaching the agreement. The Qatari foreign ministry confirmed the deal in a statement. It said, "The start of a pause in fighting will be announced within the coming 24 hours. The deal is due to last 4 days and is subject to extension, according to Doha. The humanitarian pause will also allow the entry of a larger number of humanitarian convoys and relief aid, including fuel designated for humanitarian needs," the Qatari ministry had said. And this was a statement from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last evening at the start of the government meeting. He said, "While this meeting is to discuss the return of our hostages, I would like to start with something that should be self-evident. We are at war and will continue the war. We will continue the war until we achieve all of our war aims, to eliminate Hamas, return all our hostages and our missing, and ensure that there is no element in Gaza that threatens Israel," he said in a video released on social media. Netanyahu argued that under the deal, quote, "not only will the war effort not be harmed, it will enable the IDF Israeli Defense Forces to prepare for the continuation of the fighting," end quote. The Israeli Prime Minister has told the cabinet that accepting the deal with Hamas was a, quote, "difficult decision, but it's a right decision." Israel, the United States, Germany, and several other countries designate Hamas as a terror organization. Bear with me a moment here. 1 second. This I think you'll find very interesting. The question is, the JFK assassination, 60 years on, are we nearer the truth? From Oliver Stone's JFK to the upcoming assassination, filmmakers and writers have long tried to uncover the truth behind John F. Kennedy's assassination. As the first shot was fired upon the motorcade driving through Dallas on November 22, 1963, that's today, U.S. President John F. Kennedy clutched at his throat. Seconds later, his head rocked back as he received the fatal blow. Kennedy's shocking assassination was famously captured on 8mm color film by amateur filmmaker Abraham Zapruder, having filmed from a prime position on the route of the motorcade. Zapruder's, hold on a split second. Okay, sorry about that. I had to check that out. That's definitely not for us. Okay. Okay, the footage has also allowed some to entertain the idea that suspected assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, a then 24-year-old former Marine, did not act alone. The Warren Commission, the body that investigated the circumstances surrounding Kennedy's death, adjudicated that Oswald fired three shots from the nearby Texas School Book Depository and that the second and third shots hit Kennedy's neck and head. Now, 60 years since the day that shook the world, many continue to question the origin of those history-defining gunshots. For example, upcoming film Assassination, to be helmed by Oscar-winning director Barry Levinson and starring Al Pacino, John Travolta, Viggo Mortensen, Shia LaBeouf, and Courtney Love, will explore the theory of the Chicago mob's connection with Kennedy's assassination. Scripted by two-time Oscar nominee and Pulitzer Prize winner David Mamet, Assassination tells of how Chicago mobster Sam Giancana ordered the hit on President John F. Kennedy for trying to bring down organized crime after the mob helped put JFK in the White House. Perhaps the most well-known theory was explored in Oliver Stone's 1991 epic JFK. Kevin Costner played New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, who discovered there was more to the Kennedy assassination than the Warren Commission had concluded. Garrison and his team theorized that Oswald was an agent of the CIA and was framed for the assassination. One second. Oswald spent time in the USSR, leading many to speculate over Moscow's influence. Some books have speculated the influence of Cuba, with Kennedy keen to remove the communist revolutionary Fidel Castro from power. Now, the FBI and the man who succeeded Kennedy as president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ, have also had the finger pointed at them. The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, is a book penned by Roger Stone, a Donald Trump associate, which posits that Kennedy's successor had worked with mobsters and U.S. intelligence to kill the president. Now, many of these speculative books and films have been released on or near significant anniversaries of Kennedy's death, including Stone's book, which came out 50 years after the assassination in 2013. The Final Witness speaks after decades of silence. In September of this year, The New York Times honed in on the account of Paul Landis, one of the Secret Service agents who was just feet away from Kennedy when he was shot. Landis's account, included in the forthcoming memoir, challenges the single bullet theory of the Warren Commission that one of three bullets pierced the neck of Kennedy before hitting Texas Governor John B. Connally sitting in the front seat, injuring his back Landis was never interviewed by the Warren Commission, a startling fact given his proximity to the event. The now 88-year-old has remained silent on the matter for 60 years until now. He writes in his book, The Final Witness, quote unquote, released last month, that he does not want to promote the conspiracy theories regarding Kennedy's death. However, if he refutes the claim that one bullet could have caused so much damage, it would mean that Oswald was not the only shooter. Meanwhile, the 1993 book Case Closed by Gerald Posner concludes that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, end quote. Well, Oswald was shot dead just 2 days after Kennedy's assassination by local nightclub owner Jack Ruby on live television in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. The Warren Commission found no evidence that Ruby had been involved in JFK's assassination, nor that his killing of Oswald was part of a cover-up. In December of 2022, the United States National Archives released 13,173 documents relating to the assassination of JFK. The move meant that 97% of the documents related to the assassination have now been made public. It followed a similar release of files by the Trump administration in 2017. It's a never-ending story. The Kennedy family appears to have been cursed, whether it be JFK's younger brother, Bobby Kennedy, who was assassinated as he embarked on a presidential campaign in 1968, or youngest brother, Edward Kennedy, whose own political ambitions were scuppered after leaving the scene of a car accident which caused the death of his passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne. Then there was the plane crash that saw John F. Kennedy Jr., the son and namesake of the former U.S. president, die when the light aircraft he was flying crashed into the Atlantic Ocean off Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts on July 16, 1999. Kennedy Jr. had attended his father's funeral in 1963 at the tender age of three, saluting the casket in an innocent yet inadvertently powerful gesture that would become an iconic image. From extramarital affairs and with the likes of Marilyn Monroe, his wartime heroics, support for civil rights, and prescient vows to head to the moon, but Kennedy has never failed to fascinate, especially in death. 60 years since the president was slain in his open limousine, speculation over the motive of his death could well continue for decades to come. As JFK director Oliver Stone once said of the idea that Oswald acted alone, the American public never accepted it. They smell a rat. Okay. One second. One moment here. This is interesting. It's about 2 hours old. German teachers have been bullied from German teachers bullied are going to get a school, are going to receive a school prize. Two teachers who left their schools after writing an open letter about far-right structures among the students are to receive civil courage prizes, but major changes are needed to tackle the problem of racism in school. Max Teske would rather not say where he's working now, which is understandable. In July of this year, the teacher and his colleague, Laura Nickel, were effectively hounded out of their school by far-right bullies in the town of Burg, B-U-R-G, in the eastern state of Brandenburg. After writing an open letter about the far-right structures they faced at school. In the letter that caused a nationwide stir, they said were confronted every day with far-right extremism, sexism, and homophobia, end quote. Quote, school furniture is smeared with swastikas, right-wing extremist music is heard in class, and the shouting of anti-democratic slogans fills the school's hallways, Teske and Nickel wrote. teachers and students who openly oppose right-wing student and parent groups fear for their safety, the two teachers wrote, after criticizing the, quote, wall of silence and the lack of support from the school directors, school authorities, and politicians. Once the letter was out, the two teachers' lives essentially became unlivable. Flyers appeared on lampposts around the town calling for them to, quote, F themselves, F off to Berlin. Now, 4 months after the episode, the teachers are to be honored with two Civil Courage Prizes in Berlin, one presented jointly by the Holocaust Memorial Organization and the Jewish Community of Berlin, and another from German Dream, a schools initiative that the two now work with. Tesla and Nickel have rebuilt their lives in the meantime, not only with new jobs in unnamed towns, but as public figures regularly sought for interviews and panel discussions. A lot has changed, Tesla told Deutsche Welle. On the one hand, moving out of Cottbus, the home where I lived for 31 years, and meeting new colleagues and students. On the other hand, of course, with the media presence we have from trying to make these issues public. They have also found themselves with new work as, quote, value ambassadors, end quote, for German Dream, which means leading seminars in schools where they discuss their experiences and talk to both teachers and students about how to stand up to extremism. And that has become really important for us, said Tesca. We noticed that we weren't alone and that what we did was right. Quote, I would describe ourselves as mouthpieces, and that's a role that I value a lot because there are many people stuck in situations that are even more difficult than the one I was in, he added, leaving teachers in the lurch. The head of the German Dream is Dietzen Teckel, who launched the initiative in 2019. Quote, basically, this is about the fact that we are abandoning teachers in the fight against far-right populism, against anti-Semitism, she told Deutsche Welle. The world has changed, but the curricula are still stuck in past decades. German Dreams works to fill that gap and tries to tailor their seminars, which are led by people from all walks of life, to real requests they get from teachers, whether it's to discuss issues like the Middle East, Islamophobia, or homosexuality. We got a lot of teachers writing to us, Tikal, and added, they're overwhelmed by what is happening in the world. The children come to school with a certain mindset, which they've got from their parents or the internet, and teachers can't deal with all that on their own, no matter how well-meaning they are. Statistics do show that Tesca and Nichols' experiences are not unique. Brandenburg police released new figures in October that showed 159 cases of so-called propaganda crimes, quote-unquote, in schools in 2022, mostly related to Nazi graffiti. That is more than the 136 reported in the pre-pandemic year of 2018. We knew before we wrote the letter that this wasn't just our school, said Tesca. I experienced it myself when I visited school in Spremberg, a small town in southern Brandenburg, and I was threatened and attacked by right-wing students. Breaking the wall of silence. Politicians did not react to the storm that Tesca and Nickel created. President Frank-Walter Steinmeier said he was, quote, deeply shocked, end quote, by the letter and the fact that teachers felt they had to write it. The government of Brandenburg promised to investigate the incidents that Tesca and Nickel reported, while Education Minister Stefan Freiberg denied the teachers' accusations that they had not been offered any support. Quote, we have done everything the state apparatus can do and more to protect these two colleagues, he told the Tagesspiegel, the newspaper in August. Tagesspiegel means the Daily Mirror. Freiberg, a social democrat, also promised that the government would improve action plans for dealing with violence in schools by the start of next year. Nevertheless, he admitted that society as a whole has a problem with far-right extremism. Quote, it has an effect when there is now a second generation with right-wing extremist attitudes and individual families, Feinberg told the newspaper. And the fact that there are some regionally entrenched Nazi structures is a major social drama that I have never played down. She says. Well, Bateska and Takal think that there needs to be deeper changes within schools. Quote, I think subjects like political education need to get much more space in classes. It needs to be more than once a week, said Teska. I also think there needs to be a mandatory course for teachers on the subject of democracy education. In Germany, education policy is administered by states, not by the federal government, and each determines its own level of political education, quote unquote, which, when, and how to teach the tenets of a democratic constitution. The concern about young people are not confined to Eastern Germany. The Bavarian government is also worried about the rise of far right attitudes in school. A recent mock election for under-18s in the state of Bavaria had the far-right Alternative für Deutschland, AfD, in second place with 14.9% of the vote, about the same as the actual state election where the Alternative für Deutschland, the alternative for Germany, got 14.7%. So in reaction, the Bavarian state premier Markus Söder, has floated the idea of introducing a weekly called Constitutional Quarter Hour, quote-unquote, in which classes discuss an aspect of German Constitution. Such ideas might be a good start, said Tikal, but they could go further. We need new school subjects. We need the recognition that this is a society of immigration. We have completely new problems, completely new issues, and completely new opportunities. Very compelling, to say the least. One second. One moment here. Let's look at Ukraine. Kherson, a year after the end of the Russian occupation, Kherson was the first major Ukrainian city Russia captured at the beginning of its invasion in 2022. Ukraine retook the port city after months of intense fighting. 1 year after Russian occupation, the people of Kherson are still struggling. One moment here. Bear with me a moment. No, I'm sorry. For some reason, I can't raise this article up. Bear with me a moment. This is going to be very interesting as well, though. How will the Israel-Hamas conflict impact the COP28 climate summit? This is by Catherine Scheer. As the United Nations annual climate conference convenes, the Israel-Hamas conflict in Gaza casts a long shadow. Observers suggest the conflict will impact regional cooperation and the future of Middle East environment policies. Last year, the much-praised Echo Power Project, shared by former foes Jordan and Israel, was touted as an example of how environmentally friendly policies could bring about a better future in the Middle East. Visiting the region, Germany's own economy minister, Robert Habeck, praised what was known as the, quote, water for energy, quote, unquote, project. He said that if it worked out as planned, it would be a positive example of how Arab states were cooperating with Israel and that it would, quote, build trust and be an impulse for cooperation instead of confrontation. But as of last week, hope for the project, which was supposed to see Jordan provide Israel with solar energy and Israel send Jordan desalination water in exchange, seems all but lost. tentative deal was agreed in November last year, and the final version was to be signed at this year's climate conference, COP28, in the United Arab Emirates, set to take place from November 30, so less than a week away, to December 12. Main Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi said during a TV interview on Al Jazeera last Thursday, "We will not sign this agreement any longer." Can you imagine a Jordanian minister sitting next to an Israeli minister to sign a water and electricity agreement, all while Israel continues to kill children in Gaza? End quote. This may only be one example of collateral damage to COP28. Caused by the ongoing Israel-Hamas conflict. COP28 is considered one of the world's most important international conferences on climate change because it brings together all the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. COP is short for Conference of the Parties to the Convention. There are 198, and they include all United Nations member states as well as the European Union. And it occurs annually. This is the 28th edition and is taking place in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. But as the fate of the Israeli-Jordanian deal shows, negotiators attending a COP28 will likely have to deal with at least some repercussions from the current crisis and conflict. International climate politics and climate action do not happen in a vacuum, said Ruth Towning. A research fellow at the United Kingdom-based think tank Chatham House, whose focus is climate risk and diplomacy. Quote, governments' positions are shaped by the broader geopolitical context, which constrains or enables effective action and influence, she told Deutsche Welle. Observers suggest that there are a number of ways that the Israel-Hamas conflict ongoing since an October 7 attack by the Hamas militant group might impact COP28 negotiations in both concrete and more ephemeral ways. This year's summit is expected to be the biggest one yet, and safety could be a concern for some of the around 70,000 delegates expected in Dubai amid the heated emotions the conflict is causing in the Middle East. The United Arab Emirates, a monarchy that, according to rights groups like Amnesty International, doesn't allow unauthorized or anti-government protests, has not seen the same kind of violent anti-Israel protests as other nations in the region, nor have any countries issued travel advisories or warnings about going to Dubai. Nonetheless, some countries and international companies have expressed concern. Earlier in November, Swiss bank UBS warned staff against business travel to the Middle East. Israel had planned to send around 1,000 delegates to Dubai. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had also been invited to attend and was expected in Dubai in early December. Some reports now say that the delegation will be reduced. Deutsche Welle asked Israel's environmental ministry whether the country still planned to send as many delegates and senior politicians to COP28, but the ministry did not respond before publication. Protests will likely raise the plight of Gaza. There may well be protests during the summit, too. The United Arab Emirates has said it will allow environmentally focused protests, and these, quote, will likely raise the plight of Gaza, drawing attention to how an escalating Israeli invasion with its attendant destruction of water infrastructure and services and massive displacement will have catastrophic and generational effects on Palestinians' already severe vulnerability to climate change. And Frederick Wary, a senior fellow in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, wrote in mid-October, financing for climate initiatives could also be affected, experts said. If the conflict continues to spread, it will have a negative impact on the world economy, the International Monetary Fund has warned, which would influence how much money is available to fight climate change and how richer and more polluting nations feel about financial compensation to poorer, less developed countries. Another less tangible impact may be reflected in the attitudes of different countries when it comes to agreeing to deals on environmental protection. It has been suggested that some of the senior diplomats who usually prepare for talks at COP28, which is often when deals are finalized rather than technical details debated, will have been distracted by the conflict. It's also possible that diplomats from certain countries may now be less willing to compromise with others because they stand on different sides of the conflict. Quote, because of the Western world's stance in this conflict, they, meaning the Western nations, now have to show that they are interested in multilateral development and the global fight against climate change, said Enrico Tassavior, a senior policy advisor for diplomacy in Italian climate change think tank ECHO, advised Deutsche Welle. They must show they believe in multilateralism in their foreign policy choices. Quote, in fact, he continued, this could even be an opportunity for closer cooperation to show they mean business when it comes to climate change. These negotiations could be a means to achieve peace and security, end quote. But it's not quite business as usual. Despite the list of potential impacts, most observers believe that the host, the United Arab Emirates, will do its best to partition COP28 from the conflict in Gaza. Each day at COP28 is themed with a different topic, and December 3 focuses on the health, relief, recover, and peace. That day, some countries will likely be more vocal about justice or freedom, said Tassan Viol, but that shouldn't make a huge difference to the final agenda of COP28, he added, referring to the fact that negotiations on technical details of agreements began long before COP28 and also continued after continue afterward. From a technical point of view, I think in many ways the preparatory works have given a clear direction and the path has already been set, he said. The United Nations Climate Change Body is not the United Nations Security Council. So from that point of view, I don't think they, meaning the delegates, will be blinded by the polarization of the international level about the Gaza conflict. Fatima House's Townsend hopes that concerns over a warming climate will overcome any polarization at COP28. As climate impacts increase, we are unfortunately likely to see increasing disasters, tensions, and conflicts over strained resources, she pointed out. Governments and policymakers will need to find ways to cooperate and compromise to address climate risks that, quote, cannot be put on hold while current crises, however tragic and however pressing, are tackled. Now let's look at something else. The Middle East groundwater shortage, will it soon run out? As rivers dry up and rainfall declines, water stored underground is more important than ever in the climate change impacted Middle East. The problem is nobody really knows how much is left. It is the invisible ingredient responsible for this year's bumper harvest in Iraq, a country generally considered one of the most endangered by climate change and drought in the world. It has also helped increase the number of Tunisia's all-important date palm oases, is keeping Yemen's agriculture going despite war, and ensures that Libya's bustling coastal cities are supplied with water. Groundwater, fresh water, stored underneath the earth and accessed mostly by wells, has always played a significant role in arid Middle East countries. Because it's underground, it isn't as impacted by drought and heat, and it's the main source of fresh water to at least 10 Arab nations, the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia, or ESCWA, stated in a 2020 report. But as climate change impacts what little rainfall these countries get, extremely hot summers dry up more rivers and lakes, groundwater is becoming even more important. Unseen and underground, awareness of underground water is rising, said Annabella Hudlet, a senior researcher at the German Institute of Development and Sustainability, or IDOS, who's been looking into groundwater management in Morocco specifically. In general, people have not thought about it as much as they should because they don't see it. If you see a river where levels fall dramatically, it immediately gets a reaction to continue. But groundwater is an abstract. By the time we become aware of what's happening with groundwater, it may well be too late. Making it even more complicated is the variable nature of groundwater. Mohammed Mahmoud, the director of the Climate and Water Program at the Washington-based think tank, the Middle East Institute, advised Deutsche Welle. There is growing pressure on groundwater in the region, Mahmoud said, but it's also a complicated resource. How to manage groundwater depends on what sort of ground, on rocks or rocks, it's stored in, how deep it's stored, how it flows, and how it's connected to nearby surface water like rivers and lakes. It also depends on whether the groundwater comes from renewable sources. For instance, some groundwater in the Middle East has collected underground over thousands of years. This is called fossil groundwater, and it's hard to replenish. Like oil in the ground, it's a single-use resource. These groundwater resources are found at great depths and are hardly, or not at all, renewable, explained Raymond Brentfuhrer, a project manager at the Groundwater Policy Advisory of Germany's Federal Institute for Geoscience and Natural Resources. Quote, but in recent decades, these aquifers have been increasingly tapped, end quote. On the other hand, some groundwater sources do renew regularly because of, for example, rain, he said. However, even when groundwater resources are renewable, anybody using it needs to be careful to maintain it, don't take out more water than is coming in. Measuring groundwater is crucial but difficult. Organizers like ESCWA warn this balance may not be maintained in the Middle East, but it's also very hard to know how bad the imbalance is or how to manage it. Part of the reason is that it's very hard to measure groundwater levels simply because of where it's located. Additionally, the degree in which any country in the region measures its water, whether above or below ground, varies widely. For example, in Yemen, which has been in the throes of a civil war for almost a decade now, it is extremely difficult to measure its supplies. Other countries like Saudi Arabia appear to be well aware of the groundwater levels. 2018, Saudi Arabia halted its own expansion of its agricultural program, started in the 1970s. It had relied on using groundwater to grow wheat. The end of the program indicates that the Saudis realized they were depleting their own groundwater. It's possible to measure groundwater from outer space using satellites like NASA's Gravity Recovery and Climate Equipment, or GRACE. These monitor the world's water movements, things like melting ice caps and rising ocean levels by measuring Earth's gravity. Whenever a mass shifts, it changes Earth's gravity just a little. When there's less groundwater, there's also less mass, and satellites report this information. However, GRACE does not provide data for local water management, said Blankfjord. This is where remote sensing reaches its limits. For that, one needs things like local observation wells, the water expert advised Deutsche Welle. These have to be financed, built, and regularly monitored by trained staff, which makes them an unfeasible option in some places. And Brentsjura added, not having the information is just one aspect of this. In Jordan, for example, the groundwater situation is well known, but there is a lack of enforcement to regulate water extraction for agriculture, and the rich Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia know their water resources quite well, but they're not transparent with their data. Many Middle Eastern countries already have regulations about water use, said Houdret, the IDOS, but enforcement can be problematic, she added. Houdret gave the example of a local water authority employee in Morocco who was sent out to check on illegal wells. He has one car, limited fuel, and a huge amount of territory to cover, she explained. And he is regularly greeted by stone-throwing villagers who don't want him to expect anything. So when will groundwater run out? Question is, if nobody really knows how much groundwater there is, or there still is, and at the same time its use is increasing, is there a possibility the Middle East could run out? Recent information captured by Gray satellites appears to show the Middle East's groundwater has been significantly depleted over the past decade. The United Nations ESCWA reports that many local groundwater aquifers are already being used up at a faster rate than they can be replenished. Despite such warnings, though, the truth is that nobody really knows if or when the Middle East might run out of groundwater. Groundwater involves a very complicated system that interacts with other natural systems, said Youssef Bluzin, regional representative for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Water Management Institute, a research organization headquartered in Sri Lanka. Systems involved include nearby rivers or wetlands, associated ecosystems, rainfall and coastlines, as well as pressures from salinity and pollution. Another reason why it's so difficult to pinpoint exact groundwater levels is that water doesn't respect national borders, ESCWA estimates. There are 43 transboundary aquifers in the region, but only a few countries in the Middle East have what the ESCWA described in a 2021 report as, quote, adequate, end quote, groundwater management. Additionally, if one country is extracting a lot of groundwater, but the other country that shares it isn't pulling out the same, it's very hard to tell, said Houdret. An example is provided by Libya, Tunisia, and Algeria, who shared a groundwater basin. A recent report suggests Libya runs roughly half of some 6,500 wells taking water out of the basin, while Tunisia and Algeria have far less. So the other countries might be complaining, but at the same time, they cannot really say, here's the total quantity, and you've taken too much, so now you owe me, said Houdret. Bougin does see some cause for optimism. It seems that different nations have been more likely to come together, he said. Even countries that don't deal with one another on a bilateral level will sit around the same table when it comes to water management. Notwithstanding the balance between this groundwater withdrawal and the different recharges over time should provide an answer to how sustainable water usage is and if the danger of groundwater running out is real, he said. The challenge is to balance short-term and often private interest with long-term social and environmental interests. Well, that's the end of our day today. Thank you very much for being with us. Hopefully you'll join us tomorrow as well. Take care and goodbye.